The 21st century has been an awakening on many levels, and we've spent much of this hour talking about that awakening, redefining the political parties in the United States. While the political movements of feminism and the breakdown of rigid gender roles are associated with cultural movements of the 20th century, there's plenty that remains in flux. British author Laura Bates discovered that in her book and social media project, Everyday Sexism, that women were experiencing daily incidents of sexism, often unmistakable evidence in language and other subtleties that gender equality remains an abstraction. A mom from Brooklyn noted to us that my daughter's father babysits her while I raise her.
This is Deb calling from Portland, Oregon, and I don't know where to begin. How about when my law school professor in my civil practice course, in which I wrote and argued a motion in a mock courtroom, offered only this as feedback, quote, "You look good dressed up," end quote. Are you kidding me?
Nothing subtle there. The language is in flux for women and men regarding gender roles. This discovery has fueled Laura Bates' Everyday Sexism project as a worldwide phenomenon. In the era of Nobel Prize-winning Malala, Laura Bates says, the power of gender roles makes this transition evident in different ways in all cultures, and it is something that apparently does not take a holiday.
I think that all forms of sexism are everyday, but I think that perhaps what was happening was that people didn't realize this was something that was occurring every day. When I tried to talk about gender inequality and sexism 4 years ago, people said to me, no, sexism doesn't exist anymore. Women are equal now. There is no problem. And so the term everyday sexism partly was born out of frustration that on the one hand, I was talking to hundreds of women and girls who were telling me about these experiences in the workplace, in the home, in education, in public spaces. And on the other hand, we had this incredible situation where the problem was completely invisible.
You referenced the sexualization of women in society and in commercial culture. What is interesting to me, though, is that women who are from teens to, you know, in their mid-30s are having the experience of navigating this sexualized culture because it's partly an embrace, but it's also partly a vigilance and awareness. How does that balance get worked out in the stories that you've heard from so many women who've commented and become a part of this community?
Well, I think it's incredibly complex, and I think that there's such a difference between sex and sexualization. There's a difference between a woman who is choosing to enjoy her own body and a woman who is being objectified or dehumanized by someone else. There's a difference between a woman going and sunbathing on a nude beach and an advertiser deciding to use a topless woman to sell a burger that has no relation to the product. So I think that partly it's about that sense of agency and control. Who gets to control the image? Who gets to control the way that the image is interpreted? So, for example, we'll hear from young women who choose to go out wearing whatever it is that they feel comfortable and happy in. And then if they experience harassment, which we know happens to women in all different areas at all different times of day, regardless of what they're wearing, and yet they will then have that projection of other people accusing them of having asked for it, saying, you know, you shouldn't have been wearing that. So I think it's used as a weapon against women. But I think that context is just so hugely important. Because, you know, a really good example of this, I think, is that we know that women are three times more likely than men to have to take their clothes off in major Hollywood films. And we also know that women only get 28% of speaking roles in those films, and that they're only around between sort of 5 and 10% of the directors. So I don't think that there is inherently a massive problem with the idea of showing a naked woman in a film. I think that that's something that could be done in a very empowering and a feminist way. But I think when it becomes a problem is when we're only showing a woman's naked body in a film and we're not giving her any lines alongside it. We're just putting her in there as a sex object. So I feel like it's a really complex balance to strike, and it doesn't have to be about kind of saying that sex is bad or that women shouldn't be proud of their bodies or, you know, use their bodies in whatever way that they like. But it can be a red herring, I think, that we end up criticizing women. Let's look through the other end of the telescope here and recognize that 80% of 10-year-old girls in America have dieted to lose weight. From such a young age, we tell them, your body is is what you are. Your body is expected to conform to an incredibly narrow, sexist, racist media ideal of what we consider the perfect body to look like. And we tell them this from such a young age that they take that in as, you know, this is what women are told that they are. And then when women grow up and care about their bodies and are proud of their bodies and worry about their bodies, we turn around and point at them and say, oh, you're the problem. What are you doing? I think obviously there's something else going on there. And I think it's about looking at the wider context rather than blaming an individual for their actions.
Who's the youngest woman who's contacted you, youngest woman or girl who's contacted you with a story that impressed you?
Well, the stories that we've heard start from, actually, one woman wrote about an experience that happened before she was even born, that she found out later on that when her mother had her first sonogram, her father's response was, oh God, they're twins and they're also both girls. Like, that was a kind of disaster. We heard the other day from the mother of a toddler who was 3 years old, and this little girl picked up a stethoscope at a playgroup, and immediately one of the other parents swooped in and said, oh, look, you're going to be a nurse, which is absolutely fine, of course, and a wonderful career. But what would they have said if it had been a little boy who'd picked up the stethoscope? So we hear from really, really young girls. And one of the things that's devastating, actually, is the number of stories that we receive from girls of, I'd say, around 11 or 12 years old who are having their first experiences of street harassment. And I think it's just, it's absolutely shocking. These girls are so young. They're in their school uniform. Often they're on their way to school and they're being shouted at in the street. They're being groped. They're being touched. They're being followed, approached. It's really a big shock to recognize just how early this is starting, I think.
This is a global movement, and you've had experiences and heard stories from people all over the world. In the era of Malala, a story which kind of just eclipses almost everything else that's happening, if you're talking about the developing world, what kinds of more typical stories are you hearing from young women in places like South Asia?
When we first started expanding internationally and women in different countries started their own branches of everyday sexism, I thought that we'd be seeing really clear kind of tropes, you know, or this is what's happening in Denmark, or this is what the stories from South Africa look like. And in reality, that hasn't really been the case. What's been really striking has been the similarities between the stories and the ubiquity, I think, of some common themes wherever you are in the world, things like blaming the victim of sexual violence, for example. You know, we also find, and I think this is really interesting, that one of the biggest criticisms or the biggest forms of resistance that you come up against in the United States and in the UK as well, when you try and talk about these things, is this is a problem elsewhere. You know, the really serious stuff is happening to women elsewhere. Women here are so lucky. We don't know how good we have it. And it's just so interesting, I think, that we respond in that way to something that, if it were a different kind of crisis, would be considered an epidemic. You know, so for example, the number of American troops killed in Afghanistan and Iraq between 2001 and 2012 was 6,488. And the number of American women who were murdered by current or ex-male partners during that time was 11,766. We know that three women are killed every day on average by a current or former partner in the US. We know that one in four women experiences domestic abuse. We know that hundreds of thousands of women are raped. And so we have this interesting blind spot, I think, where we want to look elsewhere and say, oh, look what women are dealing with over there. And we're not so keen to reflect on the real crisis of violence against women that we're experiencing on our own doorstep as well.
Laura Bates is founder of the Everyday Sexism Project and author of the book Everyday Sexism, out this week. Go to Facebook.com/The Takeaway to see a video from our team finding examples of everyday sexism right here in New York City's Grand Central Station. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.